From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In China, the U.S. companies have been running interference for a repressive, authoritarian regime, and now it's come back to bite them.
U.S. business leaders pressure the Bush administration to maintain relations with China. With Timothy McVeigh set to die, we'll have a commentary on collateral damage. We'll look at media interests in China. And Jews are observing Passover around the world. We'll go to a feminist seder. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush offered his first detailed budget yesterday, a $2 trillion spending plan that would make modest reductions in a wide range of programs and give the government a more conservative cast, but defers deeper cuts and potentially more dramatic shifts in priorities until next year. The budget calls for eliminating $309 million in grants to help public housing authorities get rid of drug dealers and a $162 million wetlands reserve program, and it would halve funding for research programs into renewable energy sources such as solar and wind power. The Interior Department budget received a 3% overall cut, and nearly $30 million are devoted to expanding energy-related activities on public lands. These include planning money for future oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and for an upcoming petroleum lease sale in the nearby National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The details of the president's budget lay the groundwork for congressional consideration of 13 spending bills for the fiscal year that begins this October. Already, many Republicans appear uncomfortable with the president's approach. Just 4 days ago, the Senate voted 65-35 in favor of a non-binding resolution that would increase spending more than Bush would in some areas, especially for education, health care, and defense. And the budget was denounced immediately by Democrats, who called it dead before arrival. Police used tear gas to disperse demonstrators who threw rocks and bottles at officers early today in Cincinnati as they protested the fatal police shooting of an unarmed man wanted for several misdemeanors and traffic violations. Timothy Thomas was 19 years old, from Cincinnati, was shot to death Saturday by an officer who chased him for several blocks. Thomas was unarmed. He'd been wanted on 14 warrants for misdemeanors and traffic violations, including driving without a license and failing to wear a seatbelt. Chief Thomas Stryker Jr. offered condolences to Thomas's family at a news conference yesterday. He declined to say what prompted Officer Steve Roach to shoot. This news from Hanoi, Vietnam. Officials and relatives paid grief-stricken final farewells today to eight Vietnamese killed in the crash of a helicopter carrying a team searching for Americans still missing from the Vietnam War. The eight military officers were among nine Vietnamese and seven Americans who died in the crash on Saturday. The United States spends up to $6 million each year conducting MIA searches. Since 1973, the remains of 591 American service members formerly listed as unaccounted for have been identified and returned to their families. There are more than 1,400 Americans still unaccounted for in Vietnam. A Palestinian police officer is dead and 20 other Palestinians hurt in the latest round of Middle East violence. The Israeli army rocketed Palestinian security targets in the Gaza Strip today. The attack comes only shortly after Ariel Sharon expressed regret over an incident in which Israeli soldiers fired at a convoy carrying Gaza security commanders home after a meeting with Israeli officials. A Palestinian leader rejected the statement and demanded an apology. The Israeli prime minister's gesture, which his office announced yesterday, came in a letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell. The office did not release the letter and said Sharon had no intention of apologizing. Manuel Carrascalao, a veteran of East Timor's 24-year struggle for independence, was yesterday elected to head the territory's transitional legislature. His selection to head the National Council, seen as a rehearsal body for eventual East Timorese self-rule, followed last month's surprise resignation of independence leader Xanana Gusmão. The 36-member council is appointed by the territory's UN administration. It has no direct powers, but debates and comments on regulations drafted by the United Nations. And finally, the upper house of the Dutch parliament is today set to pass a landmark bill to allow euthanasia under strict guidelines. Approval is widely seen as a formality after the lower house overwhelmingly approved the bill last November. A clear majority of the Dutch people favors the legislation. If the Senate approves the bill, the Netherlands will be the only country to make mercy killing legal.
I'll buy a shanty where the dust hangs high, from a river where things grow green, the flowers weep and they lean away from the blood-stained soil beneath my feet. The thorns outnumber the petals on the rose, and the darkness amplifies the sound of printer's ink on propaganda page that will rule your life and fuel my rage.
Terence Trent D'Arby singing As Yet Untitled here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S.-China standoff enters its 10th day, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson called U.S. statements to date unacceptable and reiterated China's demand for an apology. The spokesperson acknowledged Secretary of State Colin Powell's remarks to Fox News Sunday that Washington was sorry about the Chinese pilot, but said that it was only a step in the right direction. China's unfaltering stance has put President Bush in an awkward position. The New York Times is reporting today the administration's under growing pressure from conservatives in Congress to threaten stronger action, which could include restricting trade or selling advanced arms to Taiwan. But the administration has also been warned by business executives to assess any boomerang effects on the American economy before threatening trade sanctions. As a result, President Bush has issued only the blandest warnings to the Chinese about the diplomatic and economic risks they run in continuing to hold the 24 American servicemen and women. Business leaders are not only closing ranks around the promise of China's markets opening to American exports, China has become an important source of labor. According to a May 2000 report by the National Labor Committee, U.S. companies import 36% of China's total exports worldwide. Major U.S. corporations like Nike, New Balance, and Timberland Shoes, Kathy Lee, Walmart, and RCA TVs have factories in China, and the labor's cheap. In Timberland's factory, 16- and 17-year-old girls work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, for around 22 cents an hour. Young women, some of them only 14, also make RCA TVs. They work from 7:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. or sometimes midnight for a base wage of 25 cents an hour, and are fined 10 hours pay if they make a mistake on the production line. Just a few of the examples that have been brought out by the National Labor Committee. Charlie Kernighan now joins us, executive director of the group based here in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So tell us about this record. Very interesting what we're looking at right now in China. You could only imagine if this was North Korea who had taken U.S. service men and women who are holding them. Again, this is a result of a U.S. spy plane going down that also resulted in the, looks like the killing of, the disappearance of a Chinese pilot. But especially with the Bush administration that has been doing a lot of saber rattling around the world, the response has been remarkably restrained, and so has the press.
Well, in fact, President Bush did slip and said, well, we have a strategic partnership with China. Then he corrected himself, said, no, this is a competition, but we can partner on certain issues like trade. And one of the things they leave out, you know, they say that this $100 billion trade relationship with the United States is so key, the United States and China. They fail to tell you that we run an $83.8 billion deficit with China. In other words, China's exports to the United States exceed U.S. exports by 417%. China accounts for one quarter of our entire worldwide deficit. We export about $16.2 billion worth of goods to China. So you're talking about massive job loss associated with that tremendous deficit. But the companies are in a very uncomfortable position because they have never once said a single thing about human rights or worker rights, ever. In fact, according to them, China's doing just great. Toys R Us told us the other day that they have enormous respect for the rule of law in China. So, in fact, this stuff always comes back to bite them. China is perfect for the U.S. companies because they prefer the 16-hour shifts 7 days a week. They prefer the 20-cent-an-hour wages. They prefer the fact that if women become pregnant in the factories, they're fired. They prefer the fact that if workers try to organize, they'll be incarcerated and tortured. So just one example. Huffy bikes used to be made in the United States. The second best-selling brand. And in July of 1998, Huffy shut down in Salina, Ohio, and put 850 workers out of their job. Now, that factory had been profitable. Huffy had been profitable for 9 quarters leading up to the plant closing in 98. And in 98, Huffy made $97 million profit. But it wasn't good enough. So they threw the workers out. They were still workers, United Steelworkers of America, union people getting $17 an hour. They threw them out of work, and they took the factory to China, to a factory called Boan, the Huffy bikes. So now they're being made in China with workers paid less than 2% of what the workers in the U.S. got paid. So they'll be working from 8 o'clock in the morning until 9:30 at night, 11:30, or even to 3 a.m. in the morning. So you're talking about 13.5, 15.5-hour shifts, or even 19-hour shifts, and they'll do this 7 days a week. During the busy season in China, you'll work 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you'll get every other Sunday off, 1 day a week. Well, of course, the workers have no rights. They're paid 25 cents an hour. They get no overtime premium. And yet, if they don't work all the overtime hours, they lose 2 days' pay as punishment. The workers said that in the spray paint department, the chemical odor was so great you can't stand it. And in the welding section, the heat is so great you're passing out. They're not allowed to talk. They're housed 12 to a dorm room, a dark dorm room, they told us, crowded, fed two dismal meals a day. And when they stood up to this abusive treatment, they had a wildcat strike in the delivery section of the factory. Of course, they were all fired because in China you have no right to organize. So in a sense, you're seeing what the companies are doing. They're looking at American people, American jobs, and they want to pit the American people against workers in China under this repressive regime where they have no rights. They're stripped of their rights. And this has been their game plan all along. And in fact, even the International Trade Commission, the U.S. International Trade Commission, quite conservative. I mean, you're not talking about a left-wing organization. They estimated that job loss in the United States associated with the trade deficit between 1992 and 1999 cost 680,000 jobs in the United States. Now, this incredibly expanding trade deficit with China, of course, that's going to hurt jobs in the United States. And we're being asked to compete against 25-cent wages. I mean, look at Nike. We went to factories and saw out in front. By the way, why don't we send Walmart to China and Nike? Walmart has several thousand factories they use across China. Several thousand. Walmart's the largest importer worldwide of goods made in China. Why don't we send them there? According to them, everything's fine. According to Nike, the workers are treated great. Everything's fine. Nike has 50 contractors and 110,000 workers. Why don't we send Nike and Walmart to negotiate this crisis?
We're talking to Charlie Kernaghan, who's with the National Labor Committee based in New York, who has put out reports on U.S. corporations in China, among them Walmart Dungeon in China. I was thinking, as the calls, of course, continue to ensure the safety of the 24 servicemen and women who went down in the U.S. spy plane who are being held on Hainan Island, what if the response was not to worry. They're fine. They are working 14-hour shifts 7 days a week, 30 days a month. Average take-home pay, 3 cents an hour. One of them is earning 36 cents for an entire month's work. Almost half the workers are nothing at all and were actually in debt to the company. Now, if the Chinese response was that, not to worry, this is what's happening with the service people, of course, it would be total outrage. You're holding them at slave wages or no wages at all. You can't force these people to work. But in fact, that is the description you have of the Qinxi factory, which makes products for Walmart. By the way, as you point out, 53% of Walmart's total imports worldwide come from China.
Sure. Walmart denied that. They said they were never in that factory. They were making Kathy Lee handbags, working from 7 in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. They were doing this 7 days a week, 30 days a month, like you said, for the average wage of the 3 cents. But 46% of the workers who were housed in dormitories and fed a few dismal meals a day, the company extracted so much money from them for these pitiful dorm conditions that they actually owed the money. They actually owed the company money after several months of work. And again, these workers stood up to defend themselves in a wildcat strike, and 800 were fired. You see, in China right now, and this is going on all across China, the favored method to deal with union organizers who are trying to defend the workers in the factories or the plants, who are trying to form independent unions, is to fire those workers, incarcerate those workers in psychiatric hospitals, force feed them mind-altering drugs, and when they fight that treatment, they're given electroshock treatment. Now, this is what's going on all across China, and you don't hear a single word about it from the U.S. companies. I mean, they love this. You will see in front of contractors for Nike, it'll say, help wanted, 17 to 21 years of age, females only, single certificate necessary. So the great religious organization, Nike, that goes around the world to help develop poor countries, in China, it'll only hire young girls, young women. There's an unwritten law in the factories. You become pregnant, you're fired. You're going to find yourself working these 10 to 16-hour shifts 7 days a week for 20, 25 cents an hour. You're housed in dormitories. You're under surveillance 24 hours a day. If you're even seen discussing factory conditions, you're fired. And, of course, if you try to organize, you're imprisoned. Nike loves these conditions. And at 25 years of age, you're kicked out of the factory because you're used up. After the 17, 16-hour shifts, you're used up. Get rid of them. You bring in another crop of young girls. You have an unlimited supply. So this is the reality. And the companies just love it. You don't hear them saying a single thing.
I should say we called Walmart and asked them to be on the program today, but they said no. They would perhaps come on even to deal with your report after the crisis, so the spy plane is over. I also called Boeing in Seattle and asked if they would join us. They have a great deal of investment right now in China. They also very brisk saying they would not talk about this issue or even their own investments in China right now, that we should be talking with the U.S. government. Interestingly enough, they may have more clout, these corporations, than the U.S. government has.
Of course. The government's just running interference for them.
Well, we're going to talk about media investment in China, but this just came out yesterday. Bernie Sanders, the independent Congress member from Vermont, announced that he's co-sponsoring bipartisan legislation to revoke permanent normal trade relations, PNTR, which was most favored nation trade status with China. Sanders said it's inconceivable that the United States would retain most favored nation trading status with a country that's holding 24 American soldiers prisoner and is illegally rifling through an American airplane. Sanders has always been against most favored nation trade status for China. And it's interesting to look at the battle. I'm looking at the Financial Times today where they say that this whole situation, the crisis with the plane, could lead to a delay in China entering the World Trade Organization. But progressive movements in this country have been fighting China entering the WTO and getting PNTR.
Well, the companies are really terrified because if you look at shipping documents, you'll see what's going on. When Nike sneakers come into the United States, their landed customs value is $14.61. That's everything. That's the material, the labor, the profit to the contractor, the shipping. Total complete cost, $14.61. They then sell those sneakers to the American people at $135. That's a 924% markup. Sharper Image, the scooters they make. There's 14 cents of labor in China in an $89 Razor scooter sold at Sharper Image. That's less than 0.2% of the retail price. So the amount of profit that these companies can take out of China off the backs of workers who are repressed and stripped of their rights and forced to work these 16-hour shifts and live under these miserable conditions, it's enormous. And that's what this is, that's what this whole thing is about. The RCA televisions you mentioned, kids as young as 14 were making those televisions. Those televisions enter the United States at a customs value of $47. They're sold for $199. These are little portable televisions, sold for $199. That's a 630% markup. And yet the kids on the line who work in the 12, 14, 15, 16-hour shifts, if they made a mistake on the production line, they were fined 10 hours' wages. Alpine car stereos, $1,300 Alpine car stereos. Women in China staring into microscopes 9.5 hours a day are paid 27 cents an hour to make $1,300 Alpine car stereos that end up in our autos in the United States. This is what this is about. I mean, the companies have a vast, unlimited supply of labor that our oppressive, authoritarian government is stripping of their rights, and the companies are crawling into bed with this regime. This is what it's about.
We've been talking with Charlie Kernaghan, who is the head of the National Labor Committee based in New York. If people want to get your report on China, where on the web can they go? Where can they call?
Well, they can call us at 212-242-3002. Or they can go onto the web at www.nlcnet.org.
I also want to ask you about an interesting victory you've had with union organizing, this in Nicaragua. But before we do that, we're going to look at the Chinese media with Danny Schechter, the news dissector. Look at the U.S. corporate media and investment they're making in China today. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at U.S. corporate investment in China, we're joined by Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He's executive editor of MediaChannel.org. Had an interesting piece on his homepage, Media Prostitutes and China Coverage. What is the media interests in China?
Well, I mean, China is a big market for multinational companies. As we've heard, it's actually, you know, the whole trade thing is a misnomer. What this whole legislation is about is investment in China. It's not about trade, as in bringing stuff from China to sell here that's made in China by Chinese. It's American products that are being made in China at low costs and being brought here, and it's about investment. And in this particular instance, media companies are also invested in China and involved with China in a major way. Hence, we've seen a fairly low level of media concern and media coverage of a lot of these human rights issues in any explanatory way. Falun Gong is one. The situation in Tibet is another. The labor situation in China is a third. And in fact, we've had major corporate executives from media companies. Sumner Redstone of Viacom, which owns CBS, was in China at a big conference sponsored by Fortune magazine, Time Warner, a year ago, and he called on journalists there to in essence, not criticize the host country, in essence, not be journalists. And this is a powerful signal coming from, you know, somebody at the top of the media pecking order. A couple of months later, CBS 60 Minutes does a two-part Mike Wallace interview with Jiang Zemin that was described as a love fest. And afterwards, President Clinton runs into Jiang Zemin at the UN, and he actually says to him, he says, "How did you get away with that? That was fantastic. How can I do that?" You know, he praises Jiang Zemin for evading 60 Minutes in this particular interview. He said it was beautiful. I have actually the footage of the exchange between Clinton and Jiang Zemin in my new film on Falun Gong, which Channel 13 is airing on May 22nd in prime time. And I'm actually showing the media coverage as being part of the problem of this whole human rights situation in China. But the most egregious instance of all of this is Rupert Murdoch and Murdoch's company. Murdoch is not only involved in China, not only owns the Star satellite system, which is visible all over China. He is personally merged with China in the sense that he's married a woman from the mainland. He and his wife broke up of many years, and he's married to a woman named Wendy Deng. They live here very happily in Soho, $7 million condo. And he has been an active advocate for not covering China, in essence. And he withdrew the BBC coverage. The whole BBC was dumped from the Star satellite some years ago because China objected to its human rights reporting. More recently, James Murdoch, his son, who's now the head of Star in Hong Kong, he's been moved from his office News Corporation on 6th Avenue and 48th Street to Hong Kong. In his old office, he used to have it plastered, according to Details magazine, with pictures of Chairman Mao. So there's some sort of issue in that family with China. At any rate, he's moved there, and he just spoke at a conference organized by Michael Milken. Remember Michael Milken? He sought a presidential pardon but didn't get it. He was fined $47 million by the government for illegally doing deals with Rupert Murdoch when he was not supposed to be involved in the securities business. But nevertheless, Michael Milken has an institute now, a not-for-profit institute, and they had a big global conference, which was partly underwritten by News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch's company, and which gave his son James the right to the podium. And his son James stood up there in L.A. and denounced American journalists for being too critical of China, denounced the democracy movement, and specifically denounced Falun Gong, which was completely inappropriate and out of nowhere. He should reread his Chairman Mao, who said, you know, no investigation, no right to speak. In this case, I don't think he investigated it too carefully. Fox News Channel certainly hasn't been covering it with any depth or dimension or any of the other Murdoch properties. And basically what happened after the speech, a week later, China changed some of its rules about foreign investment in telecoms. And guess who got the first right to invest? The Murdoch News Corporation and Star Television in Hong Kong. So here you have a direct payoff, essentially, for politically supporting the Chinese government. It's disgraceful. And what's interesting about it is that it's not just me or the MediaChannel.org saying this. The Wall Street Journal's deputy features editor wrote a piece calling him a prostitute, a language that you rarely hear in the Wall Street Journal, unless it's being applied to like the Clinton administration somehow. You know, here he's denouncing Rupert Murdoch for his kowtowing to China, collusion with China, his endorsement of repression straight out in China. And all of this is really important. I mean, just riding down here with a computer software specialist, he told me about a recent trade conference where a number of American large software companies, Lucent Technology and others, I'm told, were involved in helping China design the next internet, which means a way that they can control the internet and impose all kinds of security filters and censorship mechanisms. And the censorship of the new Chinese internet is being built where? In the U.S. of A. So here's a direct involvement, a collusion of the U.S. companies and China. Also, U.S. companies, security companies have manufactured some of the devices used to torture people in China. So, you know, there's a practice here. But what's interesting about what's happening now, Amy, and this is what I love, you know, back on page 33, back in the middle of Newsweek this week, which features an article on China explaining the situation by none other than your old friend Henry Kissinger, who is identified not as a consultant for American companies doing business in China, not as a former consultant to Chinese companies doing business with America, which he did, played both parts, sides of the street. But Kissinger has an article here, and it just gives a little plug for his new book. It doesn't really in any way indicate his own interest in all this. Anyway, there's a little article that points out that the day after the spy plane came down, April Fool's Day, curiously enough, there was a little dinner in Beijing, a banquet, which was supposed to be hosted by the Vice Minister of Civil Affairs. And the guest of honor at the banquet is one Prescott Bush, uncle of the president, who turns out to be the chairman of the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce. And he just arrived in the country as part of a big American business delegation, because United Airlines has now inaugurated a flight from Chicago to Beijing, and all these people got a free flight, basically, to China. And the Chinese snubbed Prescott Bush. And this has led to a lot of concern, because it says here, with huge potential profits at stake, huge, corporate America is worrying about the fallout from the diplomatic crisis. Blue-chip U.S. companies like General Motors and Motorola have made a big bet on China, investing more than $25 billion there over the last 20 years. China has been viewed as capitalism's next frontier by American companies. And now, just as China is poised to get into the WTO, this comes along. How horrible. And we hope, they say, cool heads will prevail and get this unfortunate incident behind us. But, you know, the role of the American companies and American business and American media in China, as Charlie has been pointing out, is really central to reshaping the whole relationship between the U.S. and China. And this is why the contradictions, the term, again, we credit the great late helmsman of China for this notion of contradictions, you know, are so blatant here and so important for us to try to monitor and track. And Media Channel has been trying to cover all of this from a inside the perspective. Unfortunately, our own site has been blocked in China because we write about Chinese media coverage. You know, unfortunately, there are some radio stations in America that are beginning to resemble China in terms of the way they treat freedom of expression. But, and I will not explore that further. But the point is, you know, that these issues are really central. It's really the subtext. They're on page 33, not on page 1. And if you want to, somebody once told me, if you want to read what's really going on, you start with the business section and work to the front of the paper, not the other way around.
You're listening to Danny Schechter, who's executive editor of MediaChannel.org. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, as we talk about media in China. I just think it's very interesting that, especially for progressives in this country, there must be a relief that you don't have the kind of sort of drumbeat for war that you would expect in a situation like this, especially with George Bush at the helm, who is making enemies everywhere he goes, from North and South Korea to Japan to China to the Kyoto Treaty, saying he's going to end it, which is infuriating many countries. But you don't have that here, and there must be that a feeling of relief. And yet at the same time, you see what is preventing that is the people like you normally see being turned to in the media, like Henry Kissinger and others, and U.S. corporate executives are quiet because, and they're the ones who do the saber rattling
well,
usually.
In my column, because
they have so much investment.
In my column, I quote a media employee named Lenny, who's actually an installer for Time Warner Cable, came help me fix my cable. And Lenny said, "This incident, I'm ready to go to war on this," he said, you know. And then I said, "Lenny, chill out a little bit. You got a billion people over there. Before you and the Time Warner Cable installers take on the People's Republic of China, take a deep breath and look at what's going on here. And you'll be happy to know." Again, thank you, Newsweek. With so much at stake, business lobbyists are working their connections to promote harmony between Washington and Beijing. No one wants to see this spill over into other areas of U.S.-China relations like commerce, says Myron Brilliant. What a great name. Myron Brilliant of the Chamber of Commerce is their Asia expert. However, Ramian, here's you. Some cynics, some critics, see U.S. corporations taking China's side and weakening Bush's hand.
Well, Danny Schechter, I want to thank you for being with us. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, executive editor of MediaChannel.org. And your piece on Falun Gong will be on PBS on May 22nd.
The documentary airs May 22nd in prime time in the front lines.
I wanted to talk to Charlie Kernaghan quickly about a victory, and we're going to have to bring that to you tomorrow around the issue of Chentex and union organizing in Nicaragua. But we're going to end this segment on a different note. Interestingly enough, retailing giant Walmart has banned the sale of American terrorist Timothy McVeigh on the Oklahoma City bombing, written by Buffalo News reporters. A spokesperson for the chain, the nation's number one retailer, says, they're not going to stock it because we believe that is what most of our employees and customers would expect. And now we're going to go to a commentary by Hussein Ibish, who is a spokesperson for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, on Timothy McVeigh. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft will travel to Oklahoma City on Tuesday to meet with survivors and family members of the 168 people killed in the worst terrorist attack on American soil. Their agenda, to watch the execution of convicted bomber Timothy McVeigh. He is scheduled to die by injection May 16th. And this is what Hussein Ibish has to say about Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh, who is scheduled to be executed on May 16th, has solidified his position as the poster boy of cold-blooded villainy. The Oklahoma City bomber has once again outraged the American public when he described the 19 dead children among his 168 victims as collateral damage in an interview. Although it scarcely seemed possible, this appalling comment has made McVeigh an even more despised figure in American society. It produced widespread and justified expressions of revulsion and anger at his lack of regard for even the most innocent of his victims. There is no doubt that McVeigh is an exceptionally malevolent and brutal criminal. Yet the rest of us may not be as distant from his propensity to rationalize the killing of innocents as we prefer to believe. All too often, good people allow themselves to believe that the end justifies the means, that war is hell, or they find some other means to dismiss the deaths of those who did nothing to deserve being killed. It is worth recalling where McVeigh got this chillingly antiseptic phrase, collateral damage. It was coined by the Pentagon during the Gulf War to describe the deaths of innocent Iraqis during the massive bombing campaign in 1991, and was an attempt to obscure and rationalize these deaths through Orwellian jargon. Collateral damage during the Gulf War included, in only one instance, 313 people incinerated at the Amriya bomb shelter in western Baghdad, which was deliberately attacked. When asked about the extent of Iraqi casualties toward the end of the Gulf War, then Military Chief of Staff Colin Powell blandly remarked, "That is really not a matter I am terribly interested in." Indeed, it is not a matter that has ever seemed to concern too many Americans. The same applies to the effects of sanctions on innocent Iraqi civilians over the past decade. Asked by an interviewer if the deaths of 500,000, not 19, Iraqi children because of sanctions could possibly be justified, then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright did not dispute the figure or the causality, but instead simply remarked, "We think the price is worth it." McVeigh was a gunner on a Bradley fighting vehicle during the Gulf War and told his relatives that after the first time it got easy to kill Iraqis. It is possible that by invoking the awful phrase collateral damage, McVeigh is not only repeating a rhetorical device for denial he learned in the military service, but he is actually taunting the government and even society at large for its own propensity for callous indifference. Collateral damage was also invoked to describe the effects of attacks on civilian passenger trains, refugee convoys, and the headquarters of Radio Television Serbia during the war in Kosovo. And who remembers, or ever even cared about, the night watchman killed during the missile attack on the Al-Shifa factory in Sudan, a facility no one now denies was simply making badly needed medicines, not chemical weapons. Of course, these psychological defenses are not confined to U.S. society. They approach a depressing universality. To take another example, the process of rationalizing the death of innocents is clearly evident on both sides of the ongoing Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Objections from Americans that the Gulf and Kosovo wars were just, from Palestinians that liberation must be achieved by any means necessary, or from Israelis that they must ensure their security at all costs, merely illustrate how the process of rationalization actually works. Once we begin to accept the pernicious notion that the ends justify the means, a callous moral blindness is the inevitable result. In our tendency to rationalize and accept the killing of innocents, there may be more of McVeigh in most of us than we would care to admit.
Hussein Ibish is spokesperson for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, the Seder Sisters. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Passover began last Saturday night. The eight-day holiday celebrates the Jewish liberation from slavery in ancient Egypt. Traditionally, on the first two nights of Passover, Jewish families hold dinners or seders where friends and family gather to reflect and tell stories. Well, 10 years ago, I had a chance to go to an unusual Seder in New York, begun in 1976 by Gloria Steinem and Jewish feminist writers Esther Broner and Phyllis Chesler. This unique Passover dinner celebrated women and liberation. I produced the following piece for Pacifica Station WBAI, where we broadcast from today.
It's 6 o'clock. The women are arriving. In the dining room, there's no table, just two large sheets spread on the floor. Sheets covered with candles and one candelabra of little clay people with their arms reaching upward. You can put candles in each little hand. The women bring wine and dishes of food to share and put them in the living room for later. For now, aromas waft through the apartment. After a while, as more than 20 women fill the rooms, mothers and daughters and friends, Esther Broner calls the Seder to order. Actually, Seder means order, and the book that contains the ritual prayers and stories is called the Haggadah, Hebrew for the telling. Esther began writing her version of the Haggadah 16 years ago.
Welcome. This is our 16th Seder. This is the 16th time we've gathered together during the month of Nisan. Our reading in the synagogue this month was Leviticus, the listing of sacrifices. It makes me wonder what we as feminists sacrifice to gain a kind of spirituality, a closeness to holiness, or how we define holiness. So sacrifice is much on my mind. And war was the theme we settled on, and plagues we live under. For some of us, the war is not over. As a feminist, after reading Leviticus, as one of the tribe of Levi, the psalm writer, the singer at the temple, like Miriam, I would sacrifice, and first of all, patriotism from Patri, the father, the fatherland.
So this is about, when did you write this Haggadah?
1976, but we revise it every year. Each year, the people around bring new ideas to it. So every one of the Seders for the last 16 years has been different.
What happened in 1976 that you did this?
We declared the Seder of the North, I and three friends, one in Knesset, Marcia Friedman, a social worker named Naomi Nimrod, and I. I was teaching in Haifa, Israel then. And we no longer wanted to serve. We no longer wanted to cook. We wanted to meditate. So we declared the men the cooks and the cleaners and the servers and the women the meditators. And we wrote new prayers that ultimately became this Haggadah. And the men were not altogether happy. But it began something quite radical. And then Naomi and I spent the rest of the spring term. I was teaching in Haifa, and she was actually attending my class, as was Marshall when she came in from Knesset. And I spent the rest of the spring term writing that. Every day we went and met, and we wrote it in her late father's study. He was a cantor, and Naomi was really nervous that we were doing something desecrating. Ultimately, we were so angry with what we discovered as we began reading about the Exodus and the women, about male attitudes towards women, is that we knew that we had to make our own Exodus, and that's what happened in 76. So it was that long ago, and Ms. published in April of 77 about a third of it, which people still kill for.
What do you mean that the Exodus was only men?
Well, you read who left Egypt each time. Maybe there was one woman who left. And even when Miriam crossed the sea, she sang the same song that Moses did. She never had her own words. So by and large, the Exodus was the history of men. And it took five women to rescue Moses. It never tells about how many women it takes to rescue a woman and to make her a leader. So we felt it was a kind of paradigm that we could work with. And it turned out it had a lot of effect. To my enormous surprise, it was very popular, even in the Xeroxed form. Even Pioneer Hadassah Naamat women used it. Your most traditional of women were enraged by what they felt was the cleaning, which I'm now in the process of doing, the cleaning of the cupboards, the changing of dishes, ultimately the serving. And what your big worry is to keep the meal hot. And it seems to me that religion doesn't have anything to do with hot meals.
Of meditation,
of planning, of being together. But it is not the traditional sweet 16. We gather in strength of our 16th year, determined not to be sweet or nice Jewish girls, but to meet constantly, subversively, insistently, and to invite, to honor those left out of the Seder, our foremothers, our singer Miriam, and to give her new songs. Not war songs, but songs of crossing the sea, songs of the timbrel, songs of marching into the unknown, and with the women, with the strength, saving one's people.
Yashtinatenu mekor habracha Shehachiyanu vekimanu vehigiyanu Lazman hazeh
spread between us as sisters, and more people came into it. We now have seven of us who make it, three of us who sort of inspire it, Bella and Gloria, who wasn't able to be here today, and Grace Paley. And each year we invite a new person. Each of us invites usually one new person, sometimes more, hoping that they will go forth like little cells, form their own feminist satyrs, and learn to reshape religion. So what we're going to do is introduce ourselves by our matrilineage, our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, and by our new matriarchs. So let's go, let's see, we'll start to the left.
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by a new matriarch. You mean somebody I choose to be a matriarch?
Yes.
Does it have to be alive or dead?
No, either one. It should be either one.
Well, since Bella isn't here, it'll be Bella Abzug.
That's all I
said. I'm Jenny Leah Zlata, and my mother is Michelle next to me. My grandmother, Nachama Leah, and my great-grandmother, Zlata. And
I'm Michelle Michal Bat Nachama Leah Bat Zlata. And let's meet Gloria, another of our matriarchs.
I'm Naomi, but Dvora, but Faye, but Mrs. Grandma. I'd like to choose Rosa Luxemburg as my matriarch because she was an activist who wrote lots of love letters.
Lisa, but Diva,
but Esther, but Chayasura, and if I can choose non-Jews and non-humans, I'm choosing Jane Goodall and Flo, the old matriarchal chimp, as my matriarch.
My name is Mel, my mother is Ruth, and my grandmother is Catherine, and I'm still searching for my matriarchs.
Mother of Nechama, daughter of Beatrice, daughter of Nechama, sister of Sivia, my other grandmother. I think my matriarchs are the women who are working for peace,
from the WIMPs here on the West Side, Women Indicting Military Plans and Solutions, to the women in black who have not really been able to stand on their corners in the towns of Jerusalem, I think, since the war began. And I would like instruction in times of peace, how to continue fighting, and in terms of war, how to look towards peace from them.
And from the uncertainty of questions to the certainty of ritual, the blessing of the candles by mother and daughter, Letty and Robin Poverben. And then to the annual repetition of the four questions. Traditionally, why is this night different from all other nights? Why do we eat matzah, bitter herbs? Why do we recline while eating? But at this Seder, at Robin's apartment, one of the daughters of the original Seder sisters, the questions were slightly different. They were asked by Jenny Landsberg and answered by her mother, Michelle.
Why is this Seder different from all other Seders? And why do we still feel the need to create a feminist Seder?
Because though it's 15 years since our rabbis, Phyllis and Esther, created a Seder that celebrated the exodus of women, we are still like a lost tribe. Men still want to sing solo at the Seder, in the Knesset, in the synagogue, and at the wall. Men still insist on making laws that govern women's wombs. While men still seek to silence our voices, Miriam's daughters must sing sweeter, bolder, louder.
But next year in Jerusalem, will women rejoice in the Torah at the Western Wall? Will all people pray in equal dignity together? Will the daughters of Pharaoh's daughters join us in the dance?
Our hope and courage.
Dayenu, the English translation, it would have been enough for us. The song traditionally addresses God and is about abundance. Each verse recounts another thing God did for the Jewish people to liberate them from Egypt. And each verse ends with the word Dayenu. Just one deed would have been enough. The women's Dayenu addresses society and is about scarcity. How women's role in Jewish liberation was scarcely recognized. Each verse recounts one woman's achievement and says if just that had been acknowledged, it would have been enough.
If Chava had been created in the image of God and not as a helper to Adam, Dayenu.
Dayenu. If she had been created as Adam's equal and not been considered a temptress, it would have sufficed.
If she were the first woman to eat from the tree of knowledge and had been recognized as bringing knowledge to us, Dayenu.
If Lot's wife had been honored for compassion in looking back at the fate of her family in Sodom and had not been punished for it, Dayenu.
If our mothers had been honored for their daughters as well as for their sons, Dayenu.
If our mothers had not been considered as hardened roots or as fruit-bearing wombs, but as women in themselves, Dayenu.
If the just women in Egypt who caused our redemption had been given sufficient recognition, Dayenu.
If Miriam were given her seat with Moses and Aaron in our legacy, Dayenu.
If women had written the Haggadah and placed our mothers where they belonged in history, Dayenu.
If every generation of women, together with every generation of men, would continue to go out of Egypt, Dayenu, Dayenu.
Dayenu, 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 Dayenu,
Seder and that your women's Haggadah changed over the years. You say you've added things to it. I mean, themes, for example, this year.
We've had the same spine. We go through the same
material, because in the best traditional sense of revision is based upon the traditional Haggadah, the telling. But some years we declare a Kabbalistic year. Maybe we meditate and think about the number 9. Some years we try to think about what is it that upsets us with each other. Why aren't we working well together? And we have an intergroup mediation. Some years we've talked of losses. 2 years ago, the daughters took it and asked the mothers questions. And it was just deeply moving, probably the best Seder we ever had.
And so this year, the women talked about plagues, some internal and some external.
My plague is a sense of incompleteness. As a feminist, I'm very successful in my career, as in a man's career, by the way. And as a Jew, I feel that I'm successful in the sense that I've gotten married and starting a family, which is another sort of male world. But I feel that what I'm not successful at and I'm incomplete at is in the world of women, that all the women my generation were so busy with our careers and our families and trying to juggle both that we've forgotten about each other and that we don't have time for each other. And for me, that's a great loss.
My plague is focused at this moment on my deep alienation from my own people and Israel, and I have never felt that more strongly. My whole young life was structured around the idealism of a collective Zionism, and bit by bit it's been torn apart. And I now feel as though a Red Sea has rushed in, an angry tide between me and Israel. And I see on the far shore a people marching. Their Moses is, I see as a dwarfish Moses screaming, force, might, beatings. And I will never be reconciled, and I will never be reconciled to the pain of being so estranged from my own people. And
did it ever, in your frustration in 1976 and before, did you ever think, just throw the whole thing out, create whole new traditions?
I know the deep feeling of spirituality that women have. I'm very sympathetic to earth religions and seasonal religions, and I'm totally unsympathetic to a hierarchical religion where you bend your back looking up at a god. But the women I'm with, and Benot Aish and other women, sort of work on the edges, trying to incorporate some of the past and trying to find a religion where the creative spirit comes from within rather than above.
Esther Broner hopes someday to publish the Women's Haggadah along with a history of the feminist Seder so that women will be passed over no more. For WBAI News, I'm Amy Goodman, daughter of Dorothy, granddaughter of Sonia and Gittel, great-granddaughter of Nahama, Gita, Rivka, great-great-granddaughter.
Well, Esther Broner did write The Telling and the Women's Haggadah, both published by HarperCollins San Francisco. Today, I dedicate the program to my grandmother, Sonia Bach. She'll be 104 this week. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to write to us, you can send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!